Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, where can you sell your old PC parts? Don't call it Metro, it's Windows 8, and it's going to RTM. No, you don't need a 1,500-watt power supply, AMD's Fire Pro APU, Ivy Bridge E, Crytek 3, and using your tablet as a second monitor. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twist, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 181, recorded August 9th, 2012. Bargain GPU and the fate of Windows 8. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, the show that does its best to bring you the most exciting and important news in computer hardware and technology each and every week on the Twit Network. We want to thank you for joining us. If you like our show, please subscribe on iTunes or through twit.tv/Twitch. And do us a favor. If you like the show, forward a link to one of your friends so they can enjoy it too. I am, of course, Mr. Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Shrout, who is presently not in Texas, which is probably not making a lot of sense to those of us who are new to the podcast.
Yeah, so I spent 3 months of the summer in Austin, Texas. But no, now I'm back home in Florence, Kentucky, doing the show as I have done it for many years now and will continue to do so. Yeah, everything's good. We're good here.
Are you excited? So not too long ago, we announced that Windows 8 is, and I'm going to start with a little bit of software news today because it's important. It's Windows 8. It impacts a lot of people out there. Windows 8 shipping October 6th. Windows 8 has gone RTM, which for those of you who are new to the Windows release cycle means release to manufacturing, as is, it's done. You know, basically, Windows 8 RTM is finished, and as is prone to do, it has been pretty much leaked onto the internet. There's an editorial up on PCPer.com written by Tim Berry, and he does a pretty good job. Basically, he talks about kind of the big changes or the final changes. Quote, the leaked build is a volume licensed version of Windows 8 Enterprise. It is further an N edition, which means that it is aimed at the European market and has Windows Media Player and Windows Media Center stripped out. So basically, this is a corporate version of the operating system. Where did it go? The RTM build does not require a key to be entered to complete the install.
Right.
You know, the purple background, the Betafish is replaced by a light blue Windows 8 logo. Basically, you choose your operating system, including doing a Windows setup rollback or go to Windows 7. So it's pretty clean the way they've integrated that. After that finished, I was pleasantly surprised at what came next, says Tim. After asking for some sort of tutorial ever since the developer preview, Microsoft has finally provided one, sort of. Basically, after setup finishes, the screen goes dark and an animation pops up that briefly shows you how to access the Windows 8 Charms bar by moving your mouse to any corner of the screen. Then it dumps you out onto the desktop. Okay, so it's a little soft on that one. But there's additional desktop applications, animated screensavers. It's going to be interesting to see what shows up in the final version, the consumer version of Windows that will be shipping on the 26th. It's really odd that just this week, Microsoft announced that it's not Metro anymore. Apparently, there's a trademark conflict with a European retailer called, oddly enough, Metro, one of the biggest retailers in the world. So they basically said, it's not Metro. Metro was a code name. This is Windows 8. This is the Windows 8 interface. Do you like Windows 8 interface? Metro? Metro who?
I think that's a horrible idea. I said this last night. It feels like if it were called Metro, people could say, I like Windows 8, but I hate the Metro interface. And now they just have to say, I hate Windows 8. And I think that's going to... it's going to divide people. You know, it's interesting. So it's gone RTM. We know when it's going to be available. You know, if you try really hard, you could probably get the RTM version now. You know, are you going to upgrade right away, Patrick, on your machines? Not like your work machines, not like your testing machines where you have to do stuff for the show in Techzilla, but like your home PC that's running Windows 7 now. Are you looking forward to upgrading? Are you going to upgrade?
You know, I'm going to have it. I already have Windows 8 running literally on my production machine at work because I'm crazy like that. And I set it up because I'm really crazy on my media server at home because I like the way it bundles multiple disks into a single space. I'm going to be running it on my production system at work because I'm a little crazy. All my notebooks are primarily OS 10, and I'm waiting to see how Windows 8 – I'm waiting for Windows 8 to sort of be stabilized enough that I feel like dual booting it on my MacBook Air. But it's interesting. I thought it was – it's. I mean, it's funny you mention this because I just was reading a couple days ago Sasha Sagan, who's primarily does cell phones and mobile over at PC Mag, fantastic product reviewer. But he's really did this just kind of pissed off rant, and that was his word for it. He referred to it as a hate-filled rant, I believe. I should go check Twitter to make sure I had that right. But he basically says, look, as near as they can tell, Windows 8 PCs are going to be forced to boot into Metro. That's based on a story by Mary Jo Foley, who I think everybody knows from the Twit Network, fantastic Windows reporter. I think she has microphones all over the Microsoft campus. But, you know, what Sasha points out is that Metro is essentially designed for touchscreens. It's designed for big gestures, which are more use big gestures on screens when you're dragging them with your fingers. When you're using a mouse, it's smaller, precise gestures. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what the adoption rate is in large organizations. I think it's going to be interesting to see the consumer reaction to it. I don't know. I mean, you know, a lot of the justification behind this is to have a single, you know, development environment so that they have all of the bazillion of Windows developers making more applications for tablets and phones and stuff. But, you know, I would really like to boot as pretty as the Metro desktop is. I would like Metro to show up as maybe my screensaver and to be able to boot directly in the right desktop environment. It's interesting. Like shortcuts make Metro much more tolerable using with a keyboard and mouse. Using Metro on a tablet, I think, is absolutely fantastic.
It's
going to be very interesting.
This is honestly, and I don't even really know if it's a fair statement to make. It's like, it's the first time I just don't care. Like, I'm not interested in it. I'm not eager to move our gaming PCs to it. I'm not eager to move our GPU test beds to it. You know, NVIDIA and AMD are coming to us and saying, hey, look at us. We've got drivers for Windows 8 now. Right. We're the first, or we're the best, most qualified, whatever it is. And I just like, I'm just not intrigued by it. It's not really adding anything to the desktop space, the consumer desktop space, not, you know, people who aren't going to use Metro, you know, which I imagine most desktop users are not.
Well, it reminds me a lot of ways of the transition from, I want to say, you know, OS 9 point something, you know, to OS 10, which was huge and gut-wrenching and painful and dramatic. And everybody knew that Apple completely lost their minds. They'd given up on the traditional, you know, environment. Where's my Finder? So it's been really funny for me to watch some people I know. I've got some friends who literally, you know, every tick, every talk, they buy the new top of the line Intel processor. And these are people who are, you know, going through adding a new SSD every, you know, 6 to 8 months because they want more capacity and faster speed and literally spend money hand over fist. And they're doing stuff where they can justify having 32 gigs of memory inside their computer. And, you know, to have them just, you know, total whiny, Microsoft doing this, what are they thinking? This is horrible. And the reality is what Microsoft's trying to do is push the interface forward and make it more amenable to non-mouse and keyboard interaction. The problem is, you know, you've got several generations of computer users now that are used to using keyboards and mice to interact with their computers. Now, Intel wants you to start using a microphone and gestures because that'll require more Intel processing power. Because the reality is no matter how big your spreadsheet is, you still don't really need most of a Core i5 or a Core i3, right? You know, video gamers use it. So, you know, to cut this short before I go on too long of a useless rant, you know, I understand. I think a lot of people are going to be staring at Windows 8 being like, so I can bundle disks and Windows Media Center isn't in it unless I pay extra. And so why should I move from 7? You know, there's not a, you know, if you're comfortable with 7, there's not a lot of things going on there once you get past Metro. And when you get to Metro, you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. And if you don't love it, try learning the shortcuts. We've posted a list of those. And if those don't help you love it, then there's probably nothing that's going to save your relationship with Windows 8, except the ability to boot directly to the desktop, which makes Windows 8 go away and makes all the pretty Metro apps kind of useless. Because
right. very. But didn't they say they were going to take that ability away?
You basically, right now, my understanding is you won't be able to boot directly to the Windows 8 desktop. I have right. faith in the Windows software aftermarket to come up with a way to get
do
around.
Do you now?
I do. I have great faith in the ability to programmers to take end runs around things in operating systems that tick them off. Mm. For example, like turning off the gatekeeper block on OS X Mountain Lion. I think OS X Mountain Lion, by the way, well worth $20 for the upgrade. But watch out. There's a sort of a gatekeeper block on software. We talk about it on Techzilla that comes set standard that will basically, if it's not trusted software and it's not from Apple's store, it's going to.
Oh, looks like we lost Patrick. He was telling us about the Mountain Lion update.
Whoops.
There. That was an odd transpired. Like I knew that one was coming, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, that's what happens when you talk crap about Microsoft.
And now they own Skype. You got to be careful.
I'm calling him back.
Yeah, see if we can get him back.
All right, we're going to do a nice, let's see here, edit. Come on.
I saw his video freeze. And then the audio quality slowly degraded. And then he was gone.
I lost my amazing segue, apparently.
Dope.
Send video, please.
Weird. Hold on a second.
Your volume sounds to be very low also.
Hold on. Can you see it now? Can you see me?
Yes.
There you are.
That was weird. Is it time to reboot Skype?
You're very quiet though now too. Hold like on. The whole like the and master volume. Okay. We'll make him go away.
How about now?
Did make a difference.
Did make a difference. How about now? Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Fine Blended Edition.
No, and actually now you're on the... looks like you're on the laptop camera.
Hold on. That part was my mistake.
It's a different angle.
Sorry. It's the alternate angle.
How about now? Anything? Bueller?
Talk
Bueller?
Yes, it does sound more appropriate. But I can't see you. I cannot see
seven
you, though.
Years ago. Really?
Yeah. Really.
My video is turned on. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another Fine Blended Edition of Twitch. This week in computer hardware, where computer experts like Ryan Shrout and Patrick Norton will demonstrate that even the most sophisticated computer operators can be completely wiped out by a simple software glitch.
Your audio sounds good. Video was okay.
I can restart my machine, but I think we're back to that Skype issue.
I believe you're correct. Let us continue.
Microsoft killed my Skype for talking crap. That's entirely possible and slightly frightening.
Yeah, we know. We don't talk about it.
So in 3, 2. So yeah, I'm a little up in the air about Metro, but I am excited about Steam selling non-game software. Where did I cut out on that diatribe?
You actually were talking about the Mac Mountain Lion at the end.
Should I just skip that or?
If you want to briefly say it again, that's fine.
Okay. In 3, 2. I will say OS X Mountain Lion, $20 seems to be a pretty good investment as far as I'm concerned. Just dump the gatekeeper block on software. It's interesting. native, there's Gatekeeper. The idea is you're going to secure OS 10 from malicious software, because with Gatekeeper on, you can only install apps from the App Store or trusted apps. I think there's like a $100 fee to get your app verified by Apple. But I think that's a big step towards locking applications, basically locking applications down by the operating system, which is obviously something Apple loves to do, with, that they've done with iOS, and something Windows is following suit with the new store in Windows 8, which kind of brings us to Steam selling non-game software starting September 5th, which I think is kind of exciting. An alternative, should it not get blocked, because I guess you'll need Windows or OS 10 approval. In my nightmare world where you can only load approved software that has been approved by Apple or Microsoft, maybe Steam will be an end run around that. But I'm sure if Steam lets through applications that Apple and Microsoft don't want, they will be blocked too. But September 5th, non-game software coming to Steam. What's up with that, man?
So
they
just
need more revenues?
I think this is more of, you know, we heard about Gabe Newell's hatred towards Windows 8 in general, and how it's going to push out hardware vendors, and how it was going to cause issues with the whole software app store and that kind of thing. And I think this is like, okay, here, you know, we're gonna open up our infrastructure to non-game applications. People seem to really like Steam for games. Let's see if we can get it involved in other pieces of software. I really, really love the idea. If it works the way I'm imagining it to work, I don't know about you, Patrick, and our readers out there. How many $20 and $30 pieces of software you've probably purchased online to do various tasks, right, transcoding, whatever it is, video streaming stuff, and you always seem to lose the keys, right? And then you got to like search through your email, and you got to find the key, and you know, oh my, I formatted a system, let's reinstall this. Oh, I forgot what applications I use on a normal basis. If you have the ability now to, you know, buy that application and it's associated with your Steam account the same way a game is, where you can just download it to your computer, and as long as you're logged into Steam, you know, you can use that software. That's great. Right. In terms of, like, if you have to have a DRM, that's as easy as it gets, or as, you know, it's as comfortable as I am with a DRM, right? Sure. And you get into issues of, well, I bought this key logging software, but I don't have an internet connection on this laptop and I still want to use it, right? We'll have to figure out other things like that, like the offline modes and stuff. But I think it could be really cool. You know, it's you know, I imagine, you know, what download.com would have loved to become at the end of the day is what Steam is now, and what they could be when they start offering regular software, non-gaming software.
Cool. I'm excited. I don't know. I like Steam. I like what it does. I'm kind of excited to see what shows up on that. Plus, having bought MediaForce Mac Drive like 6 times.
Right. It was just like, you know, Steam just allows you to do things super easy, right, with gaming, as it was with when iTunes first came out with music. You just pick a song and you download it, as long as you're willing to pay. Last night, we were going to play Unreal Tournament 2004. It's like, well, this person doesn't own it. Well, it's $14. Download it. And in 30 minutes, all of a sudden, you know, you're up and running UT 2004 without having to go find CDs and stuff like that. So I'm all for anything that makes it easier. So
how did things go at the QuakeCon, the PC Perspective Hardware Workshop 2012 at QuakeCon 2012 in lovely Dallas, Texas?
Lovely and really hot. Dallas, Texas. It was good. It went great. We gave away over, I think it was like $38,000 worth of stuff in total. You can see we've actually got the video replay. If you go to pcpro.com/workshop, you can see the replay. Pretty good quality that the AV staff at the hotel convention center put on. Gave away a ton of stuff. We had, you know, 690. We had half a dozen or more 680s. We had 480s. We had 100 of those AMD APUs. NVIDIA and MSI got on stage and did demonstrations and product reveals and that kind of stuff, which were really cool. It went really well. We had a lot of fun. And, you know, it's always good to have that kind of reminder event where people that are really excited about PC hardware and they're excited about gaming and all that kind of stuff. And when you're there in front of like 1,800 of those types of people, it really feeds into you, right? Like you kind of get re-energized, and that's what I feel like that event kind of does for me as well. Is, you know, you go through the same testing a video card, writing about a video card, writing about news of a processor, you know, quarterly report and that kind of stuff. And it kind of can drain you. And it's cool to have that revitalized. So
it's nice to actually meet the people that are at the other end of the screen or the
exactly. That is a great way to put it. That's a great way to put it.
It's just neat. It's like, it's just, yeah, I completely understand feeling energized by that. You do not need a 1500 watt power supply.
God, no.
But if you do need a 1500 watt power supply because you are running multiple 690s or 680s because you're a wild creature, hardocp.com mm-hmm. has a write up by Paul Johnson, edited by Kyle Bennett, of course. The Enermax Max Revo 1500 watt power supply. I love reading their power supply reviews, but 1500 watts is completely unhinged. Did 80 plus compliance testing, the usual torture test, and it's pretty interesting. Extremely good build quality. The load testing results for the Enermax Max Revo 1500 are passing and generally very good. Where the user does seem to drag somewhat compared to the other 1500 watt units they've reviewed in the 12 volt regulation with a peak change of 0.37 volts. So there are a couple sort of better power regulation. I would say the Silverstone Strider ST1500 and Thermaltake Tough Power 1500 seem to be tied with this. 1500 watt power supply is just completely insane. Yeah, this is the largest power supply they have seen from the Enermax branding to date. And for the most part, this unit did indeed go big rather than go home. And I'm not going to reveal any more about what's going on with that power supply or the nature of the award or lack thereof from HardOCP. Because I want you to go to HardOCP.com and read it. But yeah, there's like it's amazing that there's like three or four different 1500 watt power supplies for sale right now. That's just big. A lot of juice.
We gave away a 1,350-watt power supply at the workshop. And I actually – no, here's the killer. So I gave that plus two GTX 480s, which were, you know, the power-hungry variants of Fermi when it first came out. So I thought that was a little ironic. But even then,
kind of so. Crazy. Yeah, it's funny. Also, we're over at HardOCP. They did a review of the Corsair Obsidian Series 550D mid-tower case, 20.9 by 8x7 by 19.5, but there are 4 5.25-inch drive caddies, 6 3.5-inch drive caddies, and lots of other surprises inside that case. So if you have been looking for a place to put lots of hard drives, you might want to put this on your short list, but read the article to find out how it deals with the troubles of routing water cooling lines. And it's kind of been funny also in sort of edge news for our OS X viewers. OS X, of course, LaCie is, you know, strongly associated with Apple computers. I know a lot of video editors who swear by LaCie drives, but LaCie is now basically Seagate's bought out LaCie is the short version of it. Seagate's got 64.5% of outstanding shares and a majority interest in the company. And more votes than the remaining investors combined. According to the write-up, Seagate acquires majority of shares in LaCie by Tim Berry up on PCper.com. So LaCie is now part of Seagate. And, of course, the other rumors that are boiling around is that Seagate is going to be acquiring an SSD manufacturer. We still right. don't know. You know,
I don't think this is related in any way. It just kind of gives them great entryway into the enterprise and kind of prosumer market in terms of devices, not just drives, but devices.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a very different – Seagate's very – much like Western Digital, and I'm going to get beat on next time I see some PR people from either one of those companies. But Seagate and Western Digital, no matter how shiny or glorious their external drives are always very right. meat and potatoes. And LaCie's always done stuff that's a little more shiny, happy. You know, yep. I'm going to be proud as a designer working on OS X on my MacBook. I'm going to be proud to have this beautiful silver and orange drive or this sleek black drive or whatever that was. So, yeah, the sort of positioning, the jockeying back and forth for industry control is still going on between Seagate and Western Digital. Although I think Seagate's market share is still like 60%. It's interesting if you start looking at August 2, 2012. Wow. 199 million units shipped in July 2011, 193 in 2010. That's a lot of hard drives being sold.
Yeah.
And depending on who you're looking at, it's something like 29 to 40% of the market. So lots of hard drives. And yeah, I don't know what to say about that. AMD FirePro APU is launched. Are you excited, sir?
I'd say I'm intrigued, right? So this is the first APUs have been around. We have Llano. Trinity is due up. It's been due for a little while. It's kind of been delayed for various reasons. And actually, AMD launched the FirePro A300 series, and it's actually it's the same Trinity APU that you'll be able to buy as a desktop user sometime in the not too distant future. But it's been qualified a little bit different. The drivers have been qualified a little bit differently, and they're targeting what they're calling just your most basic workstation, your entry-level workstation environment. So people that maybe will use a little bit of Photoshop, they'll do maybe the tiniest bits of CAD work. Maybe they're just looking at other people's CAD work. They're not really doing a whole bunch of stuff. They need GPU acceleration for some applications, but they don't need a lot of it. This is able, you know, to get this into that ultra-small form factor, ultra-low power use, and you're getting, you know, significantly more GPU power than you would, say, in an Atom-based box or something like that. So I'm intrigued because AMD's bet their entire life basically on the APU at this point going forward. And trying to get that into as many markets as possible makes sense. I'll be very curious to see how this gets accepted in the market for these types of things. And it has support for like four outputs, four displays, right, and that kind of thing. So you get iFinity support for, obviously not for gaming purposes, but for multi-display use, workstation use. So pretty good stuff. Cool.
Ladies and gentlemen, we wait with bated breath. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to transition to our next story about Ivy Bridge E. So Sandy Bridge E was a platform that launched not too, like, it was sometime middle late last year, and is socket 2011. And we kind of knew when we were going into the socket, we had a lot of emails and questions come into us about, hey, I'm building a new system. Do I want to build one based on, you know, Sandy Bridge or Sandy Bridge E? Do I want to wait for Ivy Bridge, right? Because Sandy Bridge and Ivy Bridge use socket 1155, and the Sandy Bridge E, which had support for quad channel memory, still does, has support for quad channel memory and has support for up to six cores, right? Depending on which SKU you get, which one was going to have the better upgrade path and all that kind of stuff. So as it turns out, based on some leaked roadmaps that we saw, Ivy Bridge E is actually not going to ship until Q3 2013. So this would be the updated versions of the 2011 platform that used the Ivy Bridge processing cores. And then we assume they'll still have quad channel memory and all that other kind of stuff. So what's interesting about that is that comes a full quarter after the expected release of Haswell, which is the next generation architecture from Intel that will be likely in the 1150. Let's see. It's a new socket called LGA 1150. So that will not be backwards compatible, but it will be a significant amount of time like behind in terms of architectural benefits. And also, we've talked over the last year or so, the main benefits of Ivy Bridge come on the GPU side, not on the CPU side. So a user upgrading from Sandy Bridge E to Ivy Bridge E is not going to see huge performance improvements unless they somehow get the clock speeds up way high. So as it turns out, there's not a lot of upgrade options for that 2011 socket kind of going forward through at least the next year. Mm. Bad news. Now, it's still a high-performing system, don't get me wrong, but it's, you know, it's one of those things people like to have options. They like to have, you know, the capabilities to know that things are going to be upgraded. So there is going to be more support for LGA 2011 and being able to upgrade down the line. But it's not going to be for at least a full year from now. At least a full year from now. So
there you have it.
Yep.
we should take a moment to sorry. Do you want to talk about the EVGA GTX 462 win that was mistakenly, I believe, priced for $169? Or should we just fire up the Crytek 3 engine trailer that you were
I just want to mention it real quick. It wasn't an accident. It was like some big promotion. It's like $180 instant rebate or something like that. I want to see. Actually, we posted this a couple of days ago. I wanted to see if it's actually still in stock. So the GTX 462 win was, it's a dual GTX 460 graphics card that when it was released, it's still in stock actually, when it was released was like $409 or something like that. But it compared in performance to the $60, $70, $80 more expensive GTX 580. And it's apparently, you know, they've got a bunch of these in a warehouse somewhere. They need to get rid of them. So with a $180 instant rebate and a $50 mail-in rebate, you can get one for $169, which is wicked cheap. Like, that's – if somebody said to me, I need to buy a graphics card for under $200 and I'm looking for gaming performance, I'm going to point them here as long as this product is still in stock. It's two cards. You get support for four displays out of it. You can do surround. You can do 3D, whatever it is. But in terms of just like raw gaming performance per dollar, that's you're basically getting the equivalent of a GTX 580 for $169, which is really cool. Very, very cool. That's still posted at PCPro.com, the link, if you guys want to look for that. I think it was at Tiger Direct. So you can see that. And that's just... Every once in a while, one of these deals comes across. It's like, you guys got to see this. And that was one. And then, yeah, the other awesome thing that I just got showed today that I wanted to share is Crytek released an engine for the Crysis 3, the CryEngine 3 demo. And it's not something we can really describe to you in audio form. If we bring up some of the video, maybe we can show that. But it's also something you need to see in person, not on a streamed video. You need to get this at the best quality you can get and get up close and look at stuff. And this is all, apparently, according to them, rendered in real time. It's all being captured locally by the system. You know, my guess is they're using a couple of 690s or something on there to get this type of stuff. But, I mean, if you just look at that, you know, I'm 15 feet away from a 22-inch monitor, and I'm looking at it, and I'm really impressed still that all that is happening in real time.
You're excited.
It is. Let's use this GPU horsepower that we have developed. Let's figure it out.
Use all the horsepower. Twitch. This week in computer hardware, Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv is the email address. We love to get your emails. You can reach Mr. Ryan Shrout at Ryan Shrout on Twitter, or you can reach me at Patrick Norton on Twitter if you have a question for us. And we love to get your questions. We love to answer your questions whenever we can. First email up today is from David. He's got a question about wireless displays. He says, I have been using AirPlay on my Mac, and it got me wondering, why isn't the AirPlay device another screen? Why is it just mirroring? So do any of the other standards treat the Wi-Fi display as a second monitor? By the way, I would really like to use an iPad or iPod Touch as a second display for my MacBook Pro or an Android tablet for a second display for my Windows box. So there are multiple stages to this answer. short answer is no protected content is... Basically, you can display protected content. You can usually display protected content either on your main screen or on a secondary screen if it's not on your main screen. But I would think that they're doing it primarily for security or for reasons that they've licensed. Basically, for whatever reason, the rights on the content usually restricts how they output some of the more interesting online content to your screen. Short answer, though, is I think they do it mirroring for simplicity's sake also, so that when, Bob in, Chula Vista does AirPlay, he can look at the big screen up there and have the same things on the little screen in front of him, which may not sound normal to you or I, but I think probably saves them a lot of tech support calls.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the original reasons that they did that is because you actually never actually saw a cursor on that mirrored display either. And the reason is because the latency in the wireless connection was so bad that, you know, trying to watch the screen and move a mouse across it was really hard to do. So they actually made it a mirror only, both because simplicity's sake and because it actually created kind of a bad user experience. Now, the next version of Intel WiDi, I think it's version 3.0. I don't really know how their naming scheme goes, will support allowing to use it as a secondary display and will allow you to do gaming through it, right? Which obviously is very latency dependent as well. But I think that's the real reason. That's one of the reasons why they haven't done it yet.
It's been interesting to watch Intel's WiDi develop over time too. So it'll be good to see that. Now, using an iPad or iPod Touch as a second display for a MacBook, I'm pretty sure there's an application that will let you use that. And
I know there is for the Mac OS.
Air Display. Air Display is on Windows. Sorry, as I like scroll down, I want to make sure the application is still available. Air Display apps. So basically, there's free server software that runs on Mac or Windows, and then there's a cheap app for iOS. So Air Display is what you're looking for to run on that. Aha! There it is, Avatron.com. No wonder I can't remember that name. It is sophisticated and intelligent, unlike me. But Avatron.com/apps air-display. And I don't know about an Android. Use Android tablet as second monitors. Nothing more exciting, ladies and gentlemen, than watching people do Google searches on camera.
Yeah, you know, the best thing we usually do here is kind of solicit the readers, listeners rather, listeners and viewers to, like, if you have an application that you think does a very good job of this. I've seen applications that will work on Windows and on Mac that will basically create, let you use your iPad as a secondary display. I've even seen, I think there was a Kickstarter for one that allows you to use your, like, phone, your Android or iOS phone as a secondary display, which seems maybe a little bit less useful, but it could be interesting, I guess, for specific use cases and that kind of stuff. So it's never been anything. I don't know. I guess I've got a 12-inch laptop. So if I had my iPad with me while I was traveling, it's big enough to be a secondary display. But if I'm at home with a 22 or 24-inch monitor, you know, maybe you use it to keep an eye on an IRC channel or to keep an eye on your chat windows or something like that, I guess, you know, specific use case. But I don't imagine it being like a really high productivity device.
But it's something you want to do. If you want to do it, Air Display on for the iPad, iDisplay for the Android. They're both pretty inexpensive. Dustin's got a question about selling old parts. He said, I had a simple question, having built a few custom computers, those of which are specifically geared towards high-end gaming. I was curious if there were any websites like Gazelle.com that would buy back used parts. I tend to upgrade GPUs every year or so, and I don't know what to do with my old ones aside from chancing eBay or local listings. I would love to get some cash back on a car that was less than a year ago, worth $400 or $300.
I don't have – this is the reason I put this email in here. Is I don't know of a service that does this, and I would love to know of this because I imagine – just like Dustin, that there are thousands and thousands of consumers doing the same thing. And the most frequent place I see this is in like hardware forums. If you go into they have, you know, for sale or for trade forums, and you can, you know, say, hey, I've got a GTX 480 and 16 gigs or 8 gigs of memory that I'm looking for that don't fit my motherboard.
Right.
Put it for sale out there. And a lot of people will check those first. But in terms of a like super easy to use mainstream kind of collection point, kind of like Gazelle is for gadgets, that would be awesome to see if anybody would do that. We don't, I'd say, hey, that's a great business opportunity for us, but I don't have enough room at this office to
start. Especially you don't want to end up with a lot of like, oh, nobody's buying the, you know, 480 cards anymore.
Yeah. Not the risk I want to take. So if you know, if you guys have an answer to that, let us know. If you do anything besides sell on Craigslist and eBay and forums and that kind of stuff, because I think it would be a really fantastic idea to have something specifically set up for that.
P. Peter's got a question about MacBook Air gaming and heat. He recently bought a 13-inch 2012 MacBook Air and was delighted to find you could play older first-person shooter games like Half-Life 2 quite nicely with the settings turned up, as long as he leaves anti-aliasing well alone. Frame rates of 70 to 90 frames per second are the norm. Good news, Peter. After playing for a while, I managed to actually hear the Air's fan roaring for the first time when I took my Sennheisers off to answer the phone. Apparently, I would like to point out at this stage, Peter has not spent a lot of time using Flash video. No doubt the fan was working, or Skype. Skype will actually cause the MacBook Air fan to roar. No doubt the fan was working at its max to keep the Ivy Bridge 1.8 gigahertz i5 cool under that kind of load, but it got me thinking, how hot is this thing actually getting, and is it okay to stay that way for hours at a time? There can't be that much air flowing through the machine, as it is only as thick as a photograph of a laptop could have hoped to have been a few years ago. I installed a temp monitor from the App Store. My results are attached. I found that 5 seconds after closing the game, the CPU cores were sitting on 80 degrees Celsius. I was a bit concerned that my reading, as my old Dell gaming laptop burned its way through two GPUs with temperatures in that range, but was soon distracted by how astonishingly quickly the core temperature readings plummeted. 4 seconds after the first reading, it had already dropped 12 degrees Celsius and kept on falling until it leveled out at 47 degrees Celsius at the 90-second mark. But 2.5 minutes after closing the game, the fan was idle again. My question is this: should I worry that excessive heat during load will do bad things to my Mac if I keep gaming on it for long periods, or be happy that Apple have done a sufficient job of engineering the cooling in this thing and continuing gaming at will? He says, I'd rather not have another laptop scorch itself into oblivion and would be willing to go elsewhere for my gaming fix if it would extend the life of my Air. So, thermal envelope. Pushing the thermal envelope, and does pushing the thermal envelope actually decrease the life of your notebook and its components?
I mean, look, they rate these things. They create the whole idea of a thermal envelope for a purpose, right? This is what they have decided is a safe temperature level to run these components at. I think it's fair to say that it's better to run them at lower temperatures for longer periods of time. But, you know, he sent us the image that I didn't include in the show notes, but, you know, he was hitting, you know, maybe 84, 83 Celsius on some of the cores, some of the CPU die immediately after exiting playing the game. And that's high. That's high up there, but it's not like it's probably rated at 95 or 100 C before it starts to melt, which would be bad.
I want to say 100 degrees Celsius is where Intel automatically starts throttling the cores back. So if you're playing and all of a sudden everything starts slowing down, you might find out that the cores have hit 100 degrees, and then what Intel has basically programmed them to do is lower the cycle number until the heat drops. I mean, the reality is Apple can't afford a whole bunch of people. Well, actually, I take that back. Apple could completely afford it. They got like $100 billion in cash sitting, you know, earning interest. But the last thing Apple wants is another debacle involving hardware overheating, like they had with some of the MacBook Pros a few years ago that had issues with the graphics, the discrete graphics hardware. So, you know, barring a failure of the mounting of the heat pipes and the other devices inside the MacBook Air, however they're conducting the heat, you know, you should be just fine. If you are not fine, you will find out that the cores will start throttling themselves down. You know, is the MacBook Air the ideal environment for cooling a CPU? No. You know, a giant water cooler is the ideal environment for cooling a CPU. Something that conducts 100% of the heat away 100% of the time under all situations is the only ideal situation for a CPU. But Intel has a lot of extraordinarily clever people figuring out how to keep the chips from blowing up, you know, right. And I don't think, you know, do I think over time overheating, you know, my gut instinct is like Ryan said, yeah, it's better if you never raise the heat up. But if you never raise the heat up, what's the point of owning the CPU? So just go with it. You know? And if it bothers you, there's external cooling solutions there. You know, the pencil under the back of your MacBook Air or some kind of a stand can help reduce the temperatures because there's more surface area being exposed to something other than your hot, sweaty lap. Getting it up off the surface of a table and, again, getting more air around it. There's active coolers that are USB powered or battery powered that will blow more air over the machine. I think those are kind of a waste. But You know, the biggest thing you want to do is make sure that the vents of the back of the machine or wherever the vents on any notebook or laptop are located are not covered. Right. Nothing makes a notebook behave more erratically than your significant other operating it in a quilt.
Yes, I have had that. Yeah, like or on a sitting on. They've got it sitting in their lap on a comforter while they're laying in bed. And I'm like, you know, you're just suffocating that thing, right? Like you're just killing, you're actively killing it.
And then you grab the notebook and scorch your fingertips. I'm thinking of a particular incident a few years ago. But short answer is like, yeah, running hardware cooler is a good idea. But it's kind of funny because it's all chips inside your notebook and the chips should be pretty strong and pretty stable. There's no hard drive, no mechanical devices to get impacted by the heat. So, you know, I would keep gaming, you know, because I would expect it to be. I find it more irritating because running, you know, if you have 100 tabs open and 15, 25, 30, 40 of those tabs have flash advertising on them, you're going to max out all of the cores of your CPU. And it's really irritating, which is why I ended up putting flash blockers on like every browser I run, which is my way of saying as irritating as gaming is, you know what? You can do the same thing by having a bunch of tabs open with flash. And I'm pretty sure Intel and Apple sat down and did the engineering on this because the last thing Intel wants is people to associate their beautiful Core i5, Core i7, Core i3 processors with thermal failures. And the last thing Apple wants is a bunch of people paying a premium for their beautiful designs to be ticked off because they did something that's well within the sort of like, yes, I would do this with my notebook. Normal people would do this with their notebook, and their notebooks are able to cook eggs on them. You know, I wouldn't worry too much about the Apple. You know, as long as you're not blocking the vents, I think it's going to be enormously difficult to fry your notebook. Of course, now that I've said that, we will get an email next week from Peter, who will have been gaming possibly on a comforter and destroyed his notebook. But
nice.
You know, you bought the notebook, use the hell out of it. That's what I'm saying.
I agree. Let's take an email from Charlie about a modest gaming upgrade. He says, I'm interested in upgrading my existing system for some modest gaming, hence the title. Skyrim, some of the Lego games for the misses, and various other 10 to 12 year old games I picked up during the Steam summer sale, all at 1080p at modest details. Since this computer is mostly used for work and video transcoding with Handbrake, it's got a pretty unremarkable GPU, the fanless ATI 5450. Since I'm a cheapskate, I'd like to get by with just an upgrade to the CPU, motherboard, and memory combo on the PC per hardware leaderboard, probably in the mid-range system. Will the GPU be too slow for my modest gaming needs with that sort of processor power under the hood? I'm pretty sure the system is currently GPU limited since the CPU is an Athlon 64 3200 plus. PS, already have an SSD in the system, so no need to recommend that. So I can say right off the bat, if he's using an Athlon 64 X2 mm-hmm. or Athlon 64 3200, pretty much anything on our leaderboard is going to be a huge difference for him in terms of CPU power and GPU power. So the current mid-range system leaderboard is a Core i5 2500K, a Gigabyte Z68 motherboard, and the Radeon 7850 graphics card, which is more than capable of accomplishing your modest, as he put it, gaming goals, right? So Skyrim, absolutely you'll be able to play. And then the Lego games and the 2 to 12 year old games you picked up during the Steam sale, definitely. I think that's funny because we played UT 2004 last night, which is 8 years old. And in the menu screen, I think I was using a GTX 670. And in the menus where the frame rate is not capped, it was hitting like 1,800 frames per second or something to that effect. It's like, this might be a little bit of overkill for this particular game. But yeah, no, I think those parts in the mid-range system would be perfect for what you're trying to do. Yeah, and they'll last you a good while as well.
There you have it. I think we're going to save the rest of our questions for next week because we're running out of time on the podcast. We have a question. We actually have asked you questions in this show. Hopefully you were paying attention. If you have an answer, email us Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv. That's the email address. We would love for you to tell all of your friends, your geeky friends, your non-geeky friends, your people that are interested in hardware to watch the show. That would be really cool. Twit.tv/Twitch is where you can find it each and every week, or subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. You can find the links to that for twit.tv/Twitch. And I got to point out that's T-W-I-C-H. There is no extra T in there. This week in computer hardware, not this week in that computer hardware. T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address. And twit.tv/Twitch is the place to find us. What's coming up on PC Per this week, man?
Probably before our next show, we'll have some new GPU news to talk about. Ooh. I know it's been a while, Patrick, since a graphics card was released. I know you're probably itching.
Is it the fastest GPU ever? Is it the 695, three 680s on a single card?
No, it is. It is not. I'm sorry. It's going to be. But the good news is it won't be that expensive either. We're going to look at our first Gigabyte motherboard with two Thunderbolt ports on it this week as well.
Ooh, Thunderbolt pass-through on a Gigabyte motherboard coming live to you at PCPer.com in the immediate future. Texilla.com is where you can find me. It's a video show I do with Veronica Belmont and Robert Heron. We have spent a lot of time talking about, A, our obsession with the Mars rover this week, and B, in the wake of Matt Honan's epic hacking that took place. By the way, if you've been following along, so a Wired writer named Matt Honan, who used to work for Gizmodo, somebody wanted his @Matt, his three-letter Twitter account, and they took advantage of a security loophole at Amazon to get a credit card, set of credit card digits to take advantage of security problem at Apple, and ended up owning his Gmail, his iCloud account, his Twitter account, which is all they really wanted, Gizmodo's Twitter account, which was a special bonus because it was still linked to Matt's Twitter account, remotely wiped his notebook and his phone, which because he hadn't backed up, took out all of his pictures of his daughter, I believe. So one, backup. Two, turn on two-factor authentication in Google and other applications if it's available. For example, Blizzard is asking you to do that right now because Blizzard's been hacked again. And if, before you say again, I would point out the Diablo 3 weirdness that took place back in May. Take a strong look at what you are using and what email accounts you have that are fairly public and start thinking about it. It's kind of nice because Amazon basically has stopped the close of the first loophole, which is allowing people to change credit card numbers or add credit card numbers by phone. Apple at least temporarily suspended the giving of passwords in exchange for the four-digit, basically the email address and a four-digit credit card associated with it. But it's been a tough week for hacking. And it's time to Ars Technica has a great article. It talks about basically sort of doing a survey of your online life and trying to figure out where the holes are and how to block them. We talked about that and kind of the 3-2-1 backup guidelines on Texilla this week. And then next week is all about shiny, fun headphone amplifiers and night vision cameras.
Yay, shiny.
Raspberry. But, well, there's... It was tough. I was on Twit actually last Sunday when Matt was on, and I feel for the guy because he just got nuked. And the scary thing is there's nothing really he could have, because of the flaws in the security at Apple and Amazon, which again, in Amazon's case have been, you know, those loopholes have been closed, and in Apple's case have been closed at least temporarily. There is not a delete expletive thing he could have done. It would have been helped if he'd had his notebooks backed up. Two-factor authentication might have stopped a lot of the mayhem. And by the way, if you have the remote wipe feature turned on in iCloud and you have any sort of nefarious evil roommates or little brothers or sisters, you might want to turn that off just in case. Although if they get access to your account.
Yeah, no joke.
But yeah, interesting week in security. So, you know, and possibly entirely too exciting. So let me say it one more time before we go. Back up your stuff before something terrible happens to it, like leaving your computer in the bathtub before the cat leaps on it or something. I don't know where that came from. Obviously, it's late and my blood sugar is low. Twitch, T-W-I-C-H at twit.tv is the email address. I'm Patrick Gordon.
I'm Ryan Schrapp.
See you next week on Twitch.